Today's episode of the Bronx Pinstripe Show is brought to you by the Bronx Brewery and their Bronx Banner Ale. It is a golden, easy ale that's perfect for summer and baseball games. It is now available at Yankee Stadium in over six sections, and you can find it at Bronx bars and around Yankee Stadium. Also, check them out at their South Bronx-based tasting room. All right, let's get into the show.
We are breaking down all aspects of Yankee baseball. This is the Bronx Pinstripe Show with your host, Andrew Rotondi and Scott Reinen. Let's go.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Bronx Pinstripe Show, episode 164. Scott, the Yankees had a day off on Monday. They go to Toronto and once again forgot how to play baseball.
Yeah, we're now calling this the Rob Refsnyder curse. Rob Refsnyder has come back, and whether he was very good in the field, it doesn't matter. Whether he's very good at the plate, it doesn't matter. He's pretty much just there to curse the New York Yankees, and that's what happened. All hail Rob Refsnyder, giving it back to the Yankees in the only way he knows how.
You get a little choked up seeing him in a Blue Jays hat?
It just doesn't look right, you know? It just doesn't look right. It just takes me back to the time where he should have been the starting second baseman, and, you know, those were painful memories because I felt like he was just getting the shaft the entire time. And now look, he's jumped countries. He's been shipped to Toronto, for God's sakes. So it's just sad, unfortunately, but life goes on. He's no longer here, so I'm not going to cry over spilt milk any longer.
I know you weren't able to catch the pregame yesterday, but Meredith was talking to him, and she asked him, were you surprised when the Yankees released you? And he said, no, I was not at all. I wasn't playing a lot recently. I wasn't playing well. Basically everything that you and I had said on this podcast, where Refsnyder saw the writing on the wall, and this is a better situation for him. Obviously, he's starting for a Major League Baseball team. So we don't need to get down the whole Refsnyder rabbit hole again, but good for Refsnyder. Just please go 0-for-4 every time the Yankees play you.
Well, yeah, and also, I mean, not that it was a surprise. He's like, what the hell is taking so long? Get me out of here so I can actually play baseball, please.
He was like Costanza trying to get fired, going out there in body suits and destroying the World Series trophies.
Got to do it. I mean, you got to get the hell out of there. You got to play baseball as a baseball player.
So I know we were kind of looking at the players' uniforms for that August weekend. It's the players' weekend where they have all nicknames on the jerseys. It looks like they're playing in spring training uniforms, and we were laughing at some of the nicknames, and I think your immediate reaction was, this was stupid.
It is stupid. The whole thing is ridiculous. I mean, it's just another ploy for look, they're going to say that this is an opportunity for the players to have fun and for Major League Baseball to loosen up and do all those things. And yeah, that's all well and good. And I feel like there's other opportunities to do that, but it's so gimmicky and dumb. And the fact that the Yankees are going to play a home game in navy blue uniforms that say with white Yankees across the chest, zero pinstripes, a white hat, and white sleeves with dumb nicknames on the back, and some of them aren't even their real nicknames, it's just stupid. It doesn't make any damn sense.
Are you really upset over this?
I'm just dumb. I'm not upset about it. I'm not really going to spend much time over, like, you know, getting upset about it. It's just dumb. It's like one of those things that it feels like, you know, some kid threw out some really dumb idea and some intern like blurted out an idea and actually people took him seriously. And now it's happening. Like,
well, this is
you wonder how it got as far as it did.
It's the MLB's answer to the NFL color rush. It's an opportunity for them to sell more jerseys. Cha-ching! And you know there's going to be so many fair-weather Yankee fans who just jumped on board this season who are going to go out and buy all-rise Aaron Judge jerseys.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. You're right. It's very clear what it is. I mean, I get it. It's a money-making thing. So as a financial, if you're looking at the financial side of Major League Baseball and them, you know, trying to sell more jerseys and more paraphernalia and all this crap, I get it. It's going to work. Kids are going to buy this stuff. But like, can we do this, I don't know, in the spring training? It would be way more fitting in spring training. It's like you're looking at a minor league game and they're rolling out there in like camo uniforms or American flag uniforms. It's pretty much on the same level for me.
And some of the nicknames are really stupid because they're not even like their regular nickname. Why is Betances D-Dog? I've never once heard anybody call him D-Dog.
Why is Pineda even out there? Why on the marketing graphic, why are we even including Michael Pineda? He's never going to wear the uniform ever again in his life.
But you can go out and buy for $59.99 a Big Mike Pineda jersey. And if I see you wearing that, I'm going to slap you.
Yeah, I mean, this is just an excuse for them to get a name on the... Look, at least they're not rolling out in some pinstripes with a name on their back. At least it didn't go that far. So at least that's a bit of a saving grace if this was actually going to happen. They just made them completely horrendous. And they just went all the way. Like, well, this is going to be dumb. Let's just make them really bad.
Not, there'll be no real names on the back except Brett Gardner, who was like, I don't have any time for this shit.
Yeah, Gardner's like, no, I'm the longest tenured Yankee. I can't do this. They're calling me their captain. I'm not putting any dumb nickname on the back. Put Gardner and let's be done with this. And please tell me when the calendar has moved to the next day, because this is stupid. You know Gardner thinks this is dumb too.
There were a couple funny, like Castro All Starlin, which I think is cocky as hell. I love that nickname for Starlin Castro.
Yeah, I don't know. It's never really been embraced. I guess a nickname for him. I've always liked the Starlin kid for some reason. It just kind of felt good to me.
Starlin already sounds like a nickname.
It does. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's hard to, it's like Sonny. I mean, you can't really give Sonny a nickname. I looked it up actually when they did that, looking at to see what Sonny Gray's nickname was, and it was oxymoron. Like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard too. That's the second dumbest thing.
You get why?
Oh, I get it, but you can't use that as a nickname.
Maybe we have to explain it for the listeners at home.
Okay, Sonny and then Gray. It's never gray when it's sunny. It's not sunny when it's gray.
Oh, I got it.
Oxymoronic.
Yeah, I see. Not to be just confused with moronic.
No. Well, John Sterling, if John Sterling endorses it, you know, it's okay for him to say, but nobody else.
Headley going with just head.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's aggressive. Just head.
I think this is an opportunity for him to change his number to 69.
Oh man, that's terrible. But
it frees up 12 too, who I don't know if you guys remember the blog I wrote a couple months back. That number 12 is like the black hole of numbers for the Yankees. It's the bizarro Yankee number is number 12.
It's an appealing one. Well, maybe not anymore with the new trend of going super high in double digits. I mean, the defensive line doesn't wear 12, so I don't know if 12 is going to be a popular number after Headley leaves. Maybe it's just one of those ones that it's avoided and people don't touch it until you get someone who's really cocky and it's like, I'm going to be the guy. It's like that restaurant that never does well and just keeps changing out as a restaurant. And they're like, I'm going to do it this time. It's going to be me. And then in 3 months, they're out of business.
Constantly changing the name and just maybe changing the color of the awning, confuse people to go back in there for their crappy food.
Yeah. Even they could change the type of food. Still going to go out of business. Still a bad location.
And I like Ellsbury. Final little nickname is Ellsbury Chief, which makes me hate Ellsbury just a little bit less. I knew that the Red Sox called him Chief, but I'm surprised. You know, this is surprising that John Sterling never went the Native American route with Ellsbury for home run calls. Maybe he thought that was a little offensive. I don't know why, because he used to call Hideki Matsui Godzilla and the Sayonara Kid, and he used to say A-bomb for A-Rod. So it was always my favorite when there would be an A-bomb followed by the Sayonara Kid.
Yeah, I mean, John Sterling will, I think he'll toy with a few of these things. I don't think he's away from offending some people. I think he's at that point. He's like an old man who could just say whatever he wants at this point. I mean, he's got tenure. He's got job security until he just can't literally see any longer, until those glasses get so thick that he cannot still not see a baseball. Although I dispute that they're working today. But yeah,
you notice
the nicknames, like, some of them are bad. I still don't get the rocket with Adam Warren too. It's talk about oxymoronic, because he doesn't throw hard and his nickname is Rocket. It's just, I don't know, man. You just keep looking down the line and they're dumb.
Was Seve on there? I didn't even notice if
Severino. Yeah, it's just Seve. Seve.
Sometimes they got lazy. So, but you've noticed, like, with Yankees Twitter, they're always constantly tweeting out the lineup in nickname form. So this is probably some contrived thing since, like, spring training that they knew they were going to have this weekend, this season. They were pushing the whole nickname and emoji thing hard this season.
Well, I'm surprised the Yankees, if they're going with these uniforms that are not their standard uniforms and they can pretty much do anything they want, why not go with the emoji on the back? Why not just take it to another level put a freaking emoji on the back? Maybe I'd like that better.
Yep, you'd get even more 9-year-olds buying those jerseys.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't technically be a name, so I think I'd be on board with that.
You see, they need us in the marketing meeting so that we can actually talk them out of these bad decisions and push them into some much better bad decisions and, like, an emoji on the back. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how it's received.
I wonder if the announcers are going to refer to the players only by nicknames that weekend.
Yeah,
which would be very annoying.
And it will be the XFL reincarnated on a baseball field at Yankee Stadium, which is, to me, sacrilegious.
So it's been a short but bad trip to Toronto so far. A couple of injury stuff. Sabathia tweaked his knee in the third inning of that game on Tuesday. Went back to New York for an MRI. I guess according to Girardi, the MRI didn't show anything bad, which is good. But there was actually a quote from Sabathia that was pretty concerning. It was Brendan Cuddy tweeted this out. Sabathia said that his knee hasn't felt this bad since 2015, which is obviously when he had all of those knee issues, started using the knee brace, and had been fine all of last year, which was a huge surprise.
Yeah, and you know, that's his Achilles heel, is his knee, is when is it going to go out? I mean, he put the weight back on. He's back to, you know, Captain Crunch CC. So at some point that body, that knee is going to give out. And I think that really is the one thing that's going to stunt him from pitching the way he can, because it seems like he's figured it out as far as the weight, you know, how to pitch now. He's figured that whole thing out, it seems like to me. So when he's healthy, I do have some trust in CC. So when you start seeing some bad starts, and he's had multiple bad starts in a row where he's getting taken out early, you know, whether it's disputed or not, whether he wanted to get pulled or not, they haven't been good. They haven't been what, you know, we're expecting from him. So it does make sense if there's some kind of an injury or if that knee is starting to swell more and become more of a problem. But that's an issue. You know, I don't know how many times you can come back from that.
By the way, you just stumbled upon a better nickname than Dub for CC, Captain Crunch.
See, that would have made a lot more sense. Dub is also lazy.
If Sabathia does hit the DL, it's still TBD. Girardi kind of hinted that Montgomery would be the leading candidate to come back up from AAA and start. Also on the pregame on Tuesday, Girardi said 180 innings is about the limit they want to get to for Montgomery. Couple of quick stats. Combined between the minors, which he only made one start, and the majors, he has 120 innings so far. So that's about 60 innings shy of that 180 number. So if CC went on the DL for an extended period of time, the clear best option is just have Montgomery come up, make his 7 or 8 starts until he gets to that innings limit, and then call it a season for him. Because the reality is, he's not going to start in the playoffs if they make the playoffs unless they have an injury.
Yeah, I feel like they're taking it easy right now so that they, at least they have an option with him down the stretch. I feel like that's the goal by looking at what the plan is, seeing the timing of the plan right now. I feel like they're trying to get to that point where they're still in it down the stretch, and then they can still utilize him if they need. You know, I don't think it's for the playoffs. Like you said, I think at that point it's almost going to be moot. I think he's going to be at that limit. Or even if he's in the playoffs, I mean, is he really going to pitch? Most likely not. So I feel like they're getting him down the stretch.
He might pitch. He might be in the bullpen, right? But that would be one inning or even one batter at a time.
And that's a new position for him at this point. I mean, he's been in the bullpen before, but he's been a starter all year. I don't know if they really want to do something like that, especially when they're really, you know, this whole plan is thinking about his long-term vision for Montgomery, and, you know, throwing him into a situation where he's almost at the innings limit and then putting him in the bullpen. I don't know. It feels like they're being very safe with him, and they're going to try to be safe with him as much as they can. So to me, they're going to start I think we might go back to that revolving door again, with starters, you know, with the occasional Montgomery coming up.
We thought we were away from it once we traded for two starting pitchers at the trade deadline. We say this jokingly all the time when everyone gets all upset at that. What are they going to do? Are they going to go to a 6-man rotation? They can't send Clint Frazier down because when Aaron Hicks comes back up, shit always works its way out. Somebody is always injured. As soon as somebody comes back, someone else bites the dust.
Yeah, or when you get to the end of the year, we're seeing now with pitch limits or innings limits, and there's just always something to manipulate, how especially starting rotations. I mean, you just cannot have enough. And we're looking at, I'm not sure where Chance Adams is right now as far as, you know, where they think you know, his innings limit is as well, but we've heard that he's coming up against that as and you know, the bullpen might be more of a clear option for him this year. But, you know, as they go on into the season, if they're trying to buy time, you know, he may be an option where, you know, Montgomery's going one and Chance Adams is doing another. I don't know. I could just see them mixing and matching to try to stretch those innings for as much as possible. But I just think they're still trying to manipulate it. I don't think that they're going to just throw Montgomery back into the fold, though. Seems like they're pretty clear on what they want to do with him.
Well, the Gumby rules, which are he's going to start every 7 days in the minors, and he's going to actually have reduced starts. So he's not even going to go like a full seven innings. He might only go five innings or even four innings in those starts. But there was a quote from Girardi when asked that said Montgomery would probably be the leading candidate to take Sabathia's start if Sabathia misses a start.
Right. And I think that they'll still try to stick on that path, though. I mean, it really doesn't matter where he starts as long as they
You're saying they would do that in the majors, too.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I could see
that's
them doing it in the majors.
Idea. How are you going to do that? That's what I'm talking about.
I think they could mess up everybody else. No, they could continue to rotate. I mean, they could keep playing that call up, call down game, send down game, and just rotating people in. I think they could do that with multiple spots. I mean, they've shown that they'll do it. So who's to say they're not? Here's the main point why I think they will not go back to Montgomery as CC's spot and keep him in that spot every fifth day is because the plan still is the plan. I mean, I understand that we're competing for this year and there's a legitimate opportunity to make it and to make a, you know, a legitimate run, but they're also not going to, you know, put the future on at risk with Montgomery. I still think that they see him as a long-term future guy. He's going to be a staple in this rotation and they don't want to screw that up. So I still think they're going to be careful with him.
Yeah. I don't equate this to a situation when the Nationals shut down Strasburg in a playoff hunt a couple years ago.
No, it's a different situation. I mean, they were a win now team. They should not have shut him down at that point. They were ready to go, and they blew an opportunity. I mean, that was one of the most bonehead things to do.
And exactly what they were trying to prevent, injuries to Strasburg, is exactly what happened to Strasburg. But he was doomed.
That guy is absolutely injury prone. I mean, the way that he throws, he's just, you know, another pitch away from another injury. So to me, shutting him down was, you know, it doesn't do anything.
Like, if we're talking about James Kaprielian in 2021, the same way we're talking about Strasburg now, I would not be surprised.
100%. I mean, the one of the things that I have been pulling out ever since they've drafted Kaprielian was that, you know, he's got a very similar motion to Mark Pryor. Mark Pryor has a very similar motion with Strasburg. All three of those guys, if you look at their delivery, are in the exact same position, and it's like death on an elbow.
But it will get you a high draft selection and a couple $1 million signing bonus.
Oh, no doubt. You can get away with it early on and you know, get your Tommy John out of the way, throw 90 some miles an hour. And if you're nasty early on, you're going to get that signing bonus. You're going to get that contract. It's just, you're not going to have a long career. It's just, there's too many guys that have had that similar motion that just don't work out and they don't have a long career. And it's, I mean, there's a number of them that have just fallen by the wayside because of it.
Not to get too like in the weeds on this whole, on like lower level baseball, but how does somebody not look at Strasburg when he's like 12 years old and thrown that way and fix it at that point?
Because he's striking kids out and their parents are like, yeah, my boy is dominating Little League. The coach is like, yeah, my guy is dominating Little League. There's high school scouts looking at him. Then the college scouts are coming. Like, they don't stop them because they're on a roll. They're just, right. They're progressing. A lot of it is complacency with the teaching. They just stop the teaching because they see a kid dominating and they just keep going. They'll tweak, but a lot of times they don't change the actual motion.
Another bit from Tuesday's game is that Mitchell came in after Sabathia, saved the bullpen, pitched really great, couldn't field his position worth a shit, made two terrible errors. I don't know if you were able to catch those errors, but he pitched great and he's actually pitched really well in the minors over his last 46 innings, 3.32 ERA, 48 strikeouts, and a really good walk rate. So Mitchell is also an option to start in the major leagues if they need somebody.
Yeah, luckily the hospital has some really good Wi-Fi, so I've been able to catch more games, which has been awesome. It's kind of a nice little getaway to watch some baseball. But, you know, the thing about Mitchell, I mean, you know, everybody knows my feelings at this point about guys with stuff. I mean, Mitchell's one of those guys. He falls into that category where he's got the stuff. He's one of those toolsy guys, and he can come out when he's on. He's really good. I mean, we think back to, what was it, 2016?
He's had a rough go of it. 2016
spring training. That, ever since then, he really hasn't gotten back to that form. You're right.
Well, 15, he came up and gets drilled in the head on a line drive.
Yeah, so it was 2016 where he won the job coming out of spring training, and then he had turf toe.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Deion Sanders nightmare injury. But, you know, I mean, look, he's got the ability to do it. He's shown it in AAA. It's a matter of Unfortunately, we have a lot of guys who have shown it in AAA and just can't translate to the majors sitting on the 40 man right now.
Caleb Smith, Luis Sessa, Brian Mitchell. Those guys are all in the same camp. I will say this, though, about Mitchell is that he has looked better than Smith and Sessa at times. Like, I could see a major league pitcher in Brian Mitchell. I watch Caleb Smith pitch and I'm like, this guy is not a major league pitcher. He might be down the road, but right now he's a AAA pitcher.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think a lot of these guys still need that seasoning, but it's frustrating when you see how well they do in AAA when they get sent back down and then they get back up and they're, you know, four innings, four runs, two
obviously
walks. You know, it's frustrating.
The talent competition is slightly different.
Oh, there's no doubt. But you also see some guys go up. I mean, it's the same with hitter. I mean, I think Refsteiner unfortunately kind of got exposed for that too. I mean, he was a guy that really always hit in AAA. I think this year was probably his worst year ever in the minors, but I mean, do I fault him? No, I love him.
Isn't it funny though? Because the guys who are like extra talented, like Aaron Judge or Clint Frazier, will come up and actually start playing better once they get to the major leagues than they did in AAA, which makes no sense to me, but it happens all the time.
No, it does. I mean, Gary Sanchez did the same thing. Look at the power numbers compared Aaron Judge with the power numbers. You see a lot of guys come up from the minors and they start figuring more things out when they get to the majors. I mean, we've had this discussion in a bit of a, I don't know if it was an argument, but it was, you know, talking about that there's more guys in the major leagues that are around the strike zone. So as a batter, you're seeing better pitches. I mean, great that you're seeing a lot more harder pitches, but you're seeing a lot more strikes as well. So if you can hit a fastball in the strike zone in AAA, you could probably do it in the majors as well.
So in that theory, would it be easier for me to make contact against a AAA pitcher than it would against a major league pitcher?
See, that's a good question. That's something I feel like we would really need to test out. But maybe the major leagues, if you can hit the fastball. The question is, I'm just not sure you can hit the fastball.
I could always hit the fastball in high school. I was always fooled on the changeups and the curveballs.
Yeah, but the high school and the high school fastball was 88, 87, maybe. And now you're looking at everybody in the major leagues is throwing high 90s. So
yeah, my high school was not that good. I don't even think the best kid was throwing 88 miles an hour.
Okay, so yeah, so your fastball in high school was an El Duque Ethos.
Yeah, I'd say like most of the people were throwing like 83 to 85.
Okay, yeah, so that's a changeup.
That is, yeah, Severino can't throw a pitch that slow.
No, he doesn't even know how to do it.
Clint Frazier scratched from Wednesday's game, right? Tightness in his right oblique, which is the same injury that Hicks had. Oblique injuries scare the crap out of me.
Especially when you're a guy who swings as violent as he does and goes, you know, just balls out on everything you do like Clint Frazier. That's definitely something that can, that is worrisome. I mean, if you're looking at it, obviously you use that oblique quite a bit, especially when you're swinging, and this dude is swinging pretty aggressively and pretty violently when he does swing. So, that's definitely something that's not looking good right now. I mean, he's been struggling too. He's definitely, if you're looking at his numbers from the beginning of when he got called up to where he is now, he's definitely, I don't know if it's the league catching up to him or, you know, maybe this injury has something to do with it, but, it's definitely worrisome for sure. And we need these guys to get healthy again. Hicks needs to get back so that, you know, if this does linger and Frazier does need to go on the DL, at least we have some reinforcements.
And you'll also remember that in September last year, Judge went down with an oblique issue.
Yes, he did.
And it was about a month. It was about a month after he was in the big leagues. Same with Frazier. Frazier's been in the big leagues for about a month, gets the oblique injury. Maybe, I don't know, maybe they're sleeping weird on the planes. They're not used to all that plane travel.
You know, and it's funny talking about how we were, you know, talking about how the depth of the rotation was something like, oh, we have six guys. What are we going to do with all these starting pitchers? Well, look at one of our biggest assets now that has been all year long in the major leagues and in AAA with the outfield. And you're seeing Clint Frazier down. Dustin Fowler's gone now. You're seeing Aaron Hicks coming back. Now we're looking thin in the outfield. And so the bottom line is you can never have enough of these guys because injuries are going to happen, especially later in the season. You're going to see more guys drop and you need the backups. And so I don't know. Hopefully this is not a long thing and he can take a couple days off and rest it and get it back.
Yeah, we're going to get a story at some point this season about how the Yankees basically went down to like their 35th to 40th man on the roster to get through this season.
Yeah, definitely. And people are going to be playing out of position at some point soon. I mean, you know, there's been talk about, you know, Andujar coming up as a DH with Holiday struggling and now on the DL. I think we're going to start seeing some creativity. And then I think we're going to see even more of that once the rosters expand. I think there's going to be a lot of guys that are getting that call up. They're going to be used more often than, you know, in years past.
couple more stats that sort of just stand out to me on the offensive side. And the Yankees did nothing on Tuesday. Garrett Cooper was the only offense. Donaldson was the only offense for the Blue Jays. He smacked two home runs. But Todd Frazier, since he's been traded to the Yankees, is hitting .207. He's got the two home runs and five RBIs, but no other extra base hits. I feel like he goes up to the plate and doesn't have really much of an approach.
It's funny because I think he was batting .207 too when he came to the Yankees.
He's a .207 hitter.
He's a .207 hitter. Yeah. This is a problem. I mean, this is a guy that was supposed to be able to figure it out, or just, you know, maybe he needed a change of scenery to get it back together. You know, he's not producing the power numbers. And I feel like we're getting back into Chris Carter territory, because this was exactly the problem. We can live with him in the low batting average and the strikeouts. But if the power's there, if he's hitting the ball out of the ballpark, if he's driving in runs occasionally and being that run producer, then you can live with the other things. And now he's not doing that too. So it's a problem. It's an absolute problem. And especially when you got a young kid like Andujar, who people are excited about and who's hitting the ball. It's interesting to see, because we all know Todd Frazier is a rental.
Frazier has been Chris Carter at the plate, but he actually does play a very good defensive.
He does. There's no doubt about that. Yeah.
So I see no way that the Yankees would go to somebody else at third base, simply because it's funny. Isn't it funny how when it was Headley at third base and Carter at first base, they both sucked. The Yankees solved one problem and Headley went over to first base and is actually producing, but now third base still sucks. So they just can't get both corners at the same time, at least producing mildly.
Yeah, it's the corners have been a black hole this year, and the only answer apparently is more Chase Headley. Just move him around.
Dude's been like depending 350, on the month. 350 since going over to first base.
He's a machine.
Maybe he was just mistaken. I mean, it was a form of mistaken identity. He's never been a third baseman. He was he's first baseman.
In a third baseman's body. He's just wearing the wrong glove and on the wrong side. Maybe he was confused.
He doesn't have to worry about throwing across the diamond anymore.
Oh, and he's been going to the wrong side of the plate. I mean, everything. He's good at everything on the right side. He's good at batting as a lefty. He's good, and they're on the right side. And first base on the right side. Maybe he just doesn't know how to do anything on the left side of the diamond.
As a third baseman, his name was Headley, and he had cable, and his hair was down. And as a first baseman, his nickname is Head, and he's got a nice slick back hair, and he's got DirecTV.
Unbelievable! It's a truly amazing transformation. And dare I say, is Chase Headley sneaking up into the team MVP talks?
Oh, shut up! But you know who's coming back? I don't know if you saw this. Brian Hoke tweeted out today that Aaron Hicks is going to be reactivated this weekend. And Starlin Castro and Greg Bird are both beginning rehabs, but Greg Bird is actually ahead of Starlin Castro.
Ooh, drama, drama, drama. Yeah, I saw that they were taking batting practice. And again, I'm not believing anything about Greg Bird until I actually see him making contact. And I hope to be very excited about him, because potentially, theoretically, this is a giant bat waiting in the wings coming to the Yankees and playing first base. So let me ask you that question. Todd Frazier still struggling. Greg Bird comes back, starts hitting. Does Headley go back to third base? Does he platoon?
It's a great question.
A lot of things coming up. If Holiday is still injured or not hitting, I mean, one of those guys will obviously fill in DH, and they'll just rotate. It's going to be a big rotation is what it's going to be.
And it's not even like you can do the lefty-ready platoon at first base with Headley and Bird, because they're both left-handed hitters, essentially.
Yeah, no, because Chase Headley does not hit right-handed very well. He literally should be done. Put it down, stop doing it, just focus on being left-handed hitter.
Getting way ahead of ourselves, assuming that Greg Bird is actually going to come back and start producing. But if he did, I think what they would do is they would DH some guys to see where Holiday is, because we haven't really heard anything about Holiday. It seems like it's going to be more than a 10-day thing. Yeah. And I think they would end up platooning Bird, Headley, and Frazier across the two positions.
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes sense, especially depending on who's pitching. You're right. I think that's exactly what's going to happen. And like I think a lot of it does depend on Holiday coming back, and if he is, you know, a shell of himself.
Yeah. Another stat from the series so far, Aaron Judge struck out twice on Tuesday, both looking, which is annoying, his 25th straight game with a strikeout. And it's the longest streak in the majors since our old friend Chris Carter back in 2012 and 2013 of 31 games.
I'm just disappointed that we've had two Chris Carter references again in this show. It's he's like never, we're reverting.
He's never leaving this podcast.
It's really a shame. When we saw that Aaron Judge last week, that home run, there was the laser beam over the right center field wall. You know, it looked like he was getting back to that approach where he's going back to the right side, being aggressive with the fastball, even earlier in the count. So, I mean, he claims that he's making that mental change, and that we're going back to where he was earlier in the season with the approach. And that approach was pretty obvious. I mean, it was taking the pitches that were outside the strike zone, and pretty simple here, not swinging at them, going the other way and finding that easy power to right field. And just, you know, he was missing the ball and still hitting it out of the ballpark. I mean, that was the guy we need back.
Like that home run he hit on Sunday in Cleveland, that looked like a single up the middle, and it somehow went over the center field wall. It's amazing when he goes to the opposite field how much more dangerous of a hitter he is. Just think back to the home run derby, not to bring up the home run derby. I know it's a sore subject with some people, but he hit half of his home runs to right field. So it's not like there's any park in the majors that can contain him from foul line to foul line. But I'm seeing him go up to the plate, and he takes a fastball down the middle on strike one. It's like you're getting a fastball down the middle. You're Aaron Judge. You need to hit that 500 feet. I don't care about working the count. You're up there to do damage.
Well, and early in the season even, you're looking at when he would even go down to an 0-2 count, he would work it back to a 3-2 count. Quite frequently. I mean, he would always work that count. And it's because he was relying on his vision to see that outside pitch, because it was given to him, just peppered that outside corner of breaking pitches, and he just wasn't swinging at it. So the problem now is that even when he's getting in the hole, he's not able to recognize that pitch. He's either swinging at it and, you know, getting out, or just missing it and just not taking the effective swings where he was. Before, he's hitting the balls to the right side, and he doesn't need to be perfect. When he's making contact to the right side, good things happen because he hits the ball so damn hard.
Yeah, it's one of those things that the one thing I want to see out of him is being more aggressive. And he talked about his mentality, as you said. I don't know if that's part of his mentality, but you strike out. I mean, he strikes out swinging, he strikes out looking. It's a lot of strikeouts for Judge. We knew that was going to be a thing. But when he's no longer hitting, when he's now hitting 150, it's becoming a real issue.
Yeah, there's no doubt. We need him back. I mean, he's obviously a very big linchpin to this offense, and I think to the team, you know, looking forward to this season. I mean, he's got to get it back to where he was, to because everybody else around him in the lineup is affected by the way he swings the bat. And unfortunately, chicken and the egg, he's affected by the rest of those guys who are not in the lineup or struggling, and so on and so on and so on.
Moving on to Wednesday's game, full disclosure, guys, Scott and I recorded the first half of this podcast before Wednesday's game. We were going to get on and record after, and of course, there's some Wi-Fi issues, and it was a late game to boot. Funny thing, of course, this always happens to us, Scott. We bash Todd Frazier. We talk about his 207 batting average in the first part of this podcast. What does he do? He goes out, he hits a home run, he gets a huge double that scores a couple runs and adds another hit, just for good measure.
Yeah, I mean, he was only a triple away from the cycle, so of course he knew that we were talking shit about him. His ears were ringing, it's fine, it worked. Look, sometimes when it works, and that's a good thing. So we're just going to continue the shit-talking of these guys until they all start hitting. So no problems.
It was a weird game, because on the one hand, the offense scored 11 runs, beat up on the Toronto bullpen. You had Frazier with the big night. You had Cooper with the big night. Home runs from Gary Sanchez and Didi, who was batting cleanup, which is just hilarious and awesome at the same time. So that's great. And then on the other hand, you had Tanaka, who went back out and regressed again. Five freaking walks. Just throw strikes, Tanaka.
It's five walks in four innings. I mean, it sounds worse when you put the innings in front of it too. I mean, this is a guy that had zero control, and one of his strengths is throwing the ball over the plate. Even when he's getting hit, it's at least balls over the plate. He floats it over the plate. He throws it too much over the plate sometimes, but no, this is he looked off. Nothing felt right. It's like, you know, sometimes it's two steps forward, one step back. Sometimes it's one step forward, two steps back. You just have no idea at this point what's coming up with him when he throws.
Yeah, he looked totally like he had such a blank look on his face too.
That's the problem. When he's bad, he has that blank look. It's like the intensity isn't there, but all his good starts, I feel like he's like super intense. It looks like he's executing and finishing pitches. It's just the body language when on his bad starts is very obvious.
He seems like he's very momentum driven this year. If his starts are going well, he has a good start, and then as soon as something starts to go bad, he just loses it and he can't battle his way through the game. And five walks in four innings is unacceptable. Another runner reached base, which I thought this was funny, on catcher's interference on Sanchez. Just add more salt to the wounds that is Gary Sanchez behind the plate. Tanaka did give up a home run. Can't get through a start without giving up a home run. 28th of the season to Bautista. The bullpen saved his ass. The offense saved his ass. Were you one of the people that was duped into thinking he had turned a corner and that the Yankees were going to be not only acquiring Sonny Gray and Jaime Garcia at the trade deadline, but they'd be acquiring Tanaka as well?
Oh, yeah. I've been thinking he turned a corner for like 2 months. I mean, shame every single you. Time he goes out, every time he goes out and puts together a really good start, I'm like, oh, okay, here it is. Here's the beginning of that the run that we've all been waiting for. Here's the beginning of that run where he makes all of this money and says, okay, the first half, don't worry about that. This is where I make all that money. This is where I make that huge run into the postseason, then opt out and get a giant contract. It's not happening. It's not happening. He's not opting out. He's staying right here. And if he's not the same Tanaka, if he's a different Tanaka, and he's this guy that we've seen all year long, then we're in for a long freaking haul with this dude. So I don't know. I don't even know if it's capable of it. I think his head is so far up his own ass at this point, and he has no idea where to turn to get the confidence or to execute pitches, or I don't even know what he's thinking on the mound anymore. It seems like every single time it's something different.
Dude, his head is so far up his own ass, it's all the way back in Japan.
Yeah, it's bad. It's not a good thing. Not a good thing to be all the way around the planet.
I don't know what's next for Tanaka as far as next year. I can't really worry about that at this point. But as far as this season goes, I think we fans just need to start treating him like a back end of the rotation guy, because that's what he's been this season. He's been a number five starter. And if we stop fooling ourselves into thinking that maybe Tanaka can be the number one or the number two guy that we've seen for the last 3 years and just say, yeah, he's our number five starter. He might go out there and pitch six strong innings, or he might go out there and not get through the fifth inning. That's just what a number five starter is, and that's what he has been this season.
Unfortunately, there's multiple of those guys. Yeah, when you're not talking about Sonny Gray, who we just acquired, and Luis Severino, who obviously is the clear number one at this point. But you can't do that, because expectations are already set in all of our minds for Masa Tanaka, some stupid ass nickname too.
He's the Masa of his own domain.
We already have expectations set. You can't get rid of those anymore. The contract is there. We know who he is. We know who he's supposed to be. We know who he needs to be. So that ship has sailed. We have these expectations. And unless he delivers to a number one status, an ace, quote, ace status, he's going to disappoint all of us.
Hey, hell, I would take a number three status at this point from Tanaka. I am pumped for Sonny Gray's start on Thursday today, as you guys are listening to this. Coming up later in this episode, we talked to Joe Stiglich of NBCSportsCalifornia.com, and he had a lot of great things to say about Sonny Gray. We tried to get him on the podcast when the Yankees traded for him. It just didn't work out, but I think it actually was good that we've seen one start of Sonny Gray's, so I'm definitely excited for his second start. Also upcoming, the Yankees play a huge series this weekend against Boston. Boston is on frickin' fire right now.
Yeah, they can't lose.
Yeah, since you've moved to Boston, I don't think they've lost a game. Eight in a row.
No, that's not true. I still have a winning record.
you mean the Red Sox have lost more games than they've won?
No, the Yankees have won more games. The win-loss record between the Yankees and the Red Sox, since I've been here, is still in the Yankees' favor.
Well, it's tilting in the wrong direction right now, but
it's getting close.
Between now and the first weekend of September, the Yankees and Red Sox play 9 times, and they're separated by 4 games in the standings. So if the Yankees have any thoughts about winning the division, they're going to have to win the vast majority of those 9 games. And if they don't, they're not going to win the division.
And that's, I think we both had kind of predicted this Boston pull away at some point. That was going to happen. I mean, they're the team that's, to me, clearly more talented and more ready for that stretch run at this point. And, we both expected that to happen. So I think the Yankees just need to keep their head above water and really shoot. I mean, yeah, shoot for the division, no doubt about it. Go after these games. But it's becoming clear that Boston is really hitting their stride, and the Yankees just need to make damn sure they're nabbing one of those wild card spots. Because they're still built for a postseason. It doesn't matter. They're still ready for that.
Yeah, and you get into that one-game playoff, obviously anything can happen, and then they've got a nasty bullpen that you think could win in a short series. So, absolutely. Right. But the division is obviously still the goal. All right, guys. All season long, we have been telling you about the Bronx Brewery's Bronx Banner Ale. It is one of my new favorite beers. It's the perfect beer for the summer. It's light and refreshing. They call it the Golden Easy Ale. It's also perfect for baseball games, and it's available at Yankee Stadium in over 6 sections around the field. You can also check them out in their South Bronx-based tasting room and at a number of bars around Yankee Stadium. If you're pre-gaming or post-gaming a Yankees game, definitely order a Bronx Banner Ale. It's kind of become their Yankees beer, and I think it's a great name. Obviously, Banner, a lot of banners up in up
27, looking for a 28th banner. There's no doubt about it. And usually those things are very hard to get. There's no doubt about it. We're seeing that this year. So the Bronx Banner Ale is not very hard to get. Go pick one up. Definitely drink it. There's also some cool things that the Bronx Brewery is doing outside of just the beer. They are working with the New York Restoration Project. It's every single case that is sold, 5% is being donated to the National Restoration Project, which is a local nonprofit focused on making the South Bronx greener and more sustainable. So you're drinking a good beer and helping the New York community.
It's always good to help the community while you can get your drink on. And it's also always good to support a local brewery in the Bronx. So if you guys want to find out where you can buy some, go to thebronxbrewery.com/find and select Bronx Banner in the dropdown and then enter your zip code. Again, that's thebronxbrewery.com/find, Bronx Banner, enter your zip code. Joining us on the podcast now is Joe Stiglich from NBCSportsCalifornia.com, and he also hosts a podcast called the A's Insider Podcast. Joe, what's up?
Not much, guys. How you doing?
Pretty good. So pretty busy out there for you in California. I know we tried to get you on last week when the trade went down, but it actually works out because we've seen Sonny Gray pitch once in a Yankee uniform. So we'll get to we've already seen it with our own eyes. Now we can hear from the source on all about Sonny Gray.
That sounds good. Yeah, it was pretty busy last week, so I appreciate the flexibility.
So what was the reaction from the Oakland fans when Sonny Gray got traded?
The reaction was, and you kind of hear this every July when the A's aren't in the race and they start dealing away some big-name veterans, people are just like, they kind of throw the, you know, it's kind of like, oh, here we go again. You know, the same storyline, the A's aren't going to be able to keep their big names. When are they going to start re-signing guys? So I think there's partly that reaction. But, you know, Sonny had been in trade rumors really going back 2 years now. So I think by the time this July rolled around, people were maybe a little more accepting of the fact that he might be gone. But I think that the main reaction, to be honest with you, when they saw what the return was from the Yankees, because two of the three prospects they got are out for the season, that's all everybody saw. And the immediate reaction was, you know what, the A's did not get enough for Sonny Gray. And I think part of that goes back to a few years ago, the aftershock of the Josh Donaldson trade. Josh was a real popular player, obviously a very impact player who also had multiple years of team control left, just like Sonny. There's a broad feeling that maybe the A's didn't get enough of a package for Donaldson. So when it comes down to it, I think people this time around are like, man, they gave away a guy like Sonny Gray. Did they get enough for him? I think there's a question in everybody's mind right now. The A's like what they got, but I think there's a question in fans' mind right now based on the injury status of Dustin Fowler and Caprillion too.
So it's funny, and I think this is a good transition into Billy Bean and kind of the thought process and how fans are thinking about Billy. I mean, obviously, he's accoladed for the whole Moneyball. He's got national recognition for a lot of that stuff as well. I'm curious how the fans of Oakland are feeling towards Billy Bean as a general manager managing the Oakland A's within the last, I don't know, 5-6 years. As I mean, obviously you bring up the Donaldson trade. That one seemed to be, you know, you can't tell until it's finished and you see what the results were on the field, and it's extremely lopsided. This guy now trading for a couple guys that were injured while they're top prospects, they're injured when you're getting them. So I'm curious as to what's the feeling surrounding Billy Bean these days in Oakland?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, I think there's increasing a little bit of impatience going on, and it's kind of been, I think fans have been doing a slow burn for a while here since the, I mean, it really hasn't been that long since they've been in the postseason. I mean, they're in the playoffs from 2012 to 2014, but since then it's been, you know, they're working on their third straight last place finish here, and, you know, the trades the past couple of years have been much like the Sonny trade. We've seen, you know, guys like Scott Kazmir, Ben Zobrist, Tyler Clipper, and last year it was Rich Hill and Josh Reddick. You know, all the kind of fan favorite type players are being shipped out, and they're mainly, you know, in return they're getting some young anonymous prospects. They're rebuilding type trades, the kind of trades that selling teams do. And after a while, fans just get impatient. You know, I think fans here are just ready for a new ballpark. They're ready for this team to start spending some money and start increasing payroll. And the A's say they will increase payroll when they get a new ballpark. They're saying they're going to announce a site in Oakland to build sometime in the calendar year. So I think the patience is waning a little bit for Billy Beane in his front office, but you can also understand a lot of this falls on the ownership too. The owners, in a way, tell the baseball ops, you know what, you got to keep the payroll at a certain point right now. We got to keep costs down right now because we're not bringing in revenue. So, you know, it depends on how you look at it. You can look at it and say the baseball ops department hasn't always swung the best trades. They haven't made the best moves. Or you can say, you know, the front office has its hands tied because they're working with a limited payroll right now. So, I mean, I think the blame is probably equally shared justifiably between the front office and the ownership for the past few years, maybe.
I also think back to him trading away Cespedes for Lester, which at the time you were thinking, okay, you're adding Lester to that rotation. And I think obviously they had Sonny Gray, and correct me if I'm wrong, they had Samardzija too at that point, right? You thought that was going to be, thought that'd be a great playoff rotation, but what he didn't realize, or well, I'm sure he realized, but what he didn't account for was that taking your cleanup hitter out of the lineup really put a hole in that order. So is it no longer in Billy Beane we trust?
Well, you know what? It depends on what segment of the fans. There's a lot of fans that still trust the A's, still trust that this front office is somehow working and doing the best with what they can work with. And there are some who just think who are getting impatient, and they say, you know, it's time to start making the playoffs again. So interesting you bring up that Lester trade. If you want to make an A's fan's blood boil, you bring up the Donaldson trade or you bring up the Cespedes trade, because those two really still strike a nerve with this with the fan base. Now, I will say about the Cespedes trade, I gave it a thumbs up when it happened. And a lot of people kind of lump that trade in with all the other trades. And they go, there was another big-name guy we gave away, and it blew up in our face. But, I mean, that was, they got back John Lester. They got back pretty much the best pitcher who was available on the trade market that year, and they needed him. You know, a lot of people don't remember. Their rotation at the time of that trade in 2014 was really shaky. You had Jason Hamill, who had also come over in the Samardzija trade, wasn't pitching well. Jesse Chavez looked like he was running on fumes. This pitching staff was in trouble. In hindsight, you definitely look back and say, you know what, they underestimated what the absence of Cespedes was going to mean, but I think a lot of people did too. I didn't see the offensive collapse coming like it did, and on that one, I give them credit for going for it, because that was an un-A's-like trade. They went for it, that was a win-now move, and it just blew up on them, you know. So people that year were kind of mad at Billy for trading Addison Russell and trading away their top prospect, and then they turned around, they got mad at him for making the opposite kind of trade, you know, and bringing in a guy like John Lester. And both moves just did not work out, but kind of for different reasons. There are different motivations behind both trades.
So the trade that we'll have to wait on to see who won. I think fans love talking about who won trade or who was, everybody jumps into conclusions very quickly. So I think with this Sonny Gray trade and the Yankees trade, we have to let it marinate for a little bit, especially on the A's side, because, you know, the guys that you got definitely have some very good potential. But talking about Sonny Gray, we're curious about, you know, the defense did not show up for him for the Yankees on his first start, unfortunately, because I thought he pitched pretty well. But talking about Sonny Gray as a big game pitcher, because in New York, obviously, it's all about winning. And we're curious to see if this is a guy that can step into that big moment and take the ball and want the ball and then deliver. So can you talk about that? I know he's had some big starts in the playoffs, but Sonny Gray is a big game pitcher.
Yeah, he has had some big starts, and he had those starts kind of early in his career. It's been a couple of years now since he's really had a big time, high profile start like that, just because his team hasn't been very good. So, Sonny's a guy who's, you look at his track record, he's done pretty well in the big games. You know, in 2013, the first year he came up, he drew the start in Game 2 against Verlander. That was a game 2 of the ALDS at the Coliseum. The A's won that 1-0, and he pitched really well, stood up to Verlander pretty good. Came back and pitched Game 5, and maybe didn't quite do quite as well against Verlander, but still didn't let things completely collapse either. And for a young guy, just in his first big league season, I think people were impressed just how he kind of handled himself on the big stage. You know, they came back in 2014, his first full year, and we're talking about that Cespedes trade in the second half, and the A's were really in a tailspin. Looked like they might go from being the best team in the majors to maybe missing out on the wild card. It came down to game 162, and Sonny went into Rangers ballpark at the time in Arlington and threw a shutout in game 162, and the A's needed that to clinch a wild card spot. So, those 2 years, he came up big when the team needed him most. And obviously, the A's just haven't, since 2015, they haven't had a whole lot of big games like that, and Sonny's had some injury issues. But when it comes to the big stages and the big games that he's pitched, for the most part, you got to say he's risen to the occasion.
2015 was his best season so far. He finished third in the Cy Young voting. And then he kind of had a rocky 2016. I know there was some injury issues like you just mentioned. Yeah. Other than the injuries, do you just equate it to injuries, or was there something else that you saw that didn't allow him to get back to that Cy Young type pitcher?
He clearly was not himself last year, and I think it puzzled him a little bit. It puzzled the coaching staff, because I don't think anybody really saw that coming. Most of all, Sonny, and for the whole season, he was on the DL twice for extended periods, but when he was healthy and pitching, he was constantly kind of searching for answers, and that was clear in talking to him in his post-game interviews. He was searching for answers, too. Now, fast forward to the A's Fan Fest before this season, and Sonny kind of opened up about his injuries, and he blames a lot of last year's struggles mainly on his physical condition, saying he didn't feel good all year, and he thinks his mechanics kind of got thrown off based on him being injured. That's a common thing with pitchers. So I know as he was coming back last year, trying to work back from his second injury, which was a forearm strain towards the end of the year, he was putting in a lot of time just on his mechanics too. And coming into this year, he said he not only felt healthy, but he felt like his mechanics were a little, he said he was just more compact. He just felt better about his mechanics. So I think last year was a combination of health and a combination of the mechanics getting away from him. One thing you saw last year, which you didn't see prior, was he'd get ahead of guys and counts, and he just was not able to put them away. He'd bounce his slider, near home plate. He'd throw wild pitches, and he'd let hitters catch up in the count again. He just couldn't put guys away. He just did not have his command last year all around. And whether or not, it was all about the injuries, if you take him at his word, he says it was all his physical issue. But this year, he had the lat strain early this year and was on the disabled list. When he came back from that and he was 100%, he looked more like the Sonny of 2015.
So you thinking, talking to Sonny in the first half and then the doctors as well and the trainers, people like to throw the injury-prone label around, especially for pitchers. Do you see that as him? Because when you're looking at, just looking at the actual injuries in the book, they seem like they're relatively minor injuries, nagging things, things that may take some time to get over. Do you see him as a guy, looking at his mechanics, looking at all the things that he does as injury-prone?
I think people, that comes from people who just say he's an undersized guy, and the track record for undersized major league starting pitchers isn't great, and they seem to be injury prone. The track record is what it is. His first couple of years, he was a workhorse, and he was durable, and he was completely fine. And last year, he broke down a couple times. In the beginning of this year, he had the lat strain. All the injuries didn't seem like they were so much related. So, I don't know if I'd say he's injury prone, but it depends on who you talk to and how people feel about it. He is an undersized guy, and people look at that and say that maybe in the long term he's not going to hold up. So, we'll see. He's been healthy this year. He's looked really good, and for the most part, he has been healthy this year. But it's a little bit of a question mark moving forward, no doubt about it. I'm sure the Yankees had to weigh that a little bit before they decided to pull the trigger on this trade.
Well, that's a good thing, because usually the Yankees get pitchers when they're 37, not 27, and they break down a lot faster. So having a guy that might not hold up deep into his mid-30s or something like that, at least we got him in his prime. But one thing I noticed, one thing I noticed about his start last week was that he had four to five pitches going, and it was awesome to see. Talk about his evolution as a pitcher from when he came up as a rookie until now.
Yeah, I think it has been an evolution a little bit. I think when he came up, he was a fastball, and just a fastball and curveball guy, kind of more of a 12-6 curve too, and those were his two pitches. And really since then, he's developed, he throws the two-seamer a little bit more, he's got the changeup going, he kind of manipulates the four-seamer a little bit and throws a bit of a cutter. And he's just he's just pretty nifty when it comes to like making things up on the fly too. That's when the A's had Stephen Vogt, and Steven was the catcher who's caught Sonny in the major leagues more than anybody. Steven would just say, this guy can literally make up pitches during the course of a game. And a lot of times Steven says, I didn't know what was going to be coming. That made him difficult to catch sometimes, because So then he's got a way of just being able to tweak a pitch here or there, whether it's his fastball, to get it to cut a little bit more or take some speed off the fastball. He's just kind of a, like I said, a nifty guy when it comes to doing something like that. You know, he's able to just kind of tweak things a little bit and really manipulate things in the course of a game. And I haven't heard that said about a lot of other pitchers I covered with the A's. So he's still a fastball guy, but he throws a slider a little bit more, and he can equally throw the slider and the curveball equal effectiveness in games. You know, the curveball's obviously got less velocity on it. The slider's got a little harder, a little more bite to it. But it's all about having the command and being able to get those ground balls. But he really does have four or five pitches he can go to at any time.
It's funny because I think when the trade was rumored to happen, and then when it did happen, there were some old quotes from David Ortiz that kind of resurfaced during that, talking about how he looked at Sonny Gray and, you know, he's just like a kid that doesn't look like he can do much, and then took him
called him the Apple IT guy.
Yeah, the Apple IT guy. That's
right.
It. And then took him for a ride with all the different types of pitches. So he was. It seemed like Ortiz was very impressed, and just it wasn't expected either. So I think he comes out and sneaks up on people too.
I think it's a combination. You look at the size, and he's still got the baby face going. I mean, with the A's, his last days with the A's, he was trying to grow the beard, and he'll tell you he wasn't having too much success doing it. And he's just got that baby face look to him still. You know, just a polite, you know, humble Southern kind of guy. And I think that all plays into it, too. And he's not the biggest guy, obviously. He's under 6 foot. So you look at him on the mound, and maybe he's not the most intimidating presence, especially early in his career. But I remember when Ortiz was saying that caught a lot of buzz, you know, a hitter of that stature having those good things to say about Sonny.
It seems like the whole Oakland clubhouse was all about some Sonny Gray. They really, I guess he meshed well in that clubhouse. There was a story about Oakland watching Sonny's first start as a Yankee in their clubhouse. So can you talk to us a bit about what he is, or, you know, kind of his stature in the clubhouse and with the rest of the guys?
Yeah, he was. He had a presence in there, and he's not the most vocal guy, and I don't think he's a big rah-rah guy. I mean, who knows what happens behind clubhouse doors when all of us in the media aren't allowed in, but he was a pretty quiet guy. I think he led by example. And, you know, the thing about him was, like I said, he kind of became an ace-type figure, that staff, at a very young age and a very early point in his career. I mean, you could say by the end of 2013, that was his first half season, him and Bartolo Colon were the two co-aces of that staff. And it just continued. By the time he came back in 2014, you felt like you were talking to a guy who was an established big league or front of the rotation type guy, and you kind of forgot, you know, this is this guy's first his first full season still. So he always just seemed like he was a little more advanced than his age and his development would suggest. I believe when the A's drafted him out of Vanderbilt, I believe they sent him straight to AA out of college, you know, and that's pretty rare. So he was always on the fast track to get to the major leagues. And, you know, this clubhouse has always been a guy with young pitching. I mean, they usually have a veteran around. They'll have a Rich Hill or a Scott Kazmir or a Bartolo who young guys can look to. But I think after a pretty short time, guys were looking to Sonny Gray, too, just because of the respect he commanded, because of the body work he had so early on in his career.
All right, final question from me, and be honest on this one. How often do you have nightmares about the Derek Jeter flip play?
You know what? That play is, I mean, I grew up rooting for the A's. I grew up rooting for the Giants, too. I grew up in the Bay Area. That play, I can just look back at that play and just kind of marvel at what a legendary, amazing play it was. Because right when it happened, you knew that was going to go down to the books as one of the all-time great postseason plays. So, I mean, at that time, you know, that time I was actually working for, I had my first newspaper job. I had covered some A's games a little bit at that point. So I was honestly able to watch it kind of as a reporter, not so much as a diehard fan living and dying with every pitch. So I was just kind of enjoying the game for what it was. And I mean, that play is going to go down in infamy in A's history, you know, for that and the Jeremy Giambi no slide. And it was just kind of, you know, just kind of an example of the A's in the postseason early 2000s. Whatever could go wrong would go wrong. And I mean, that play helps cement Jeter's legacy, obviously.
Are Oakland fans still saying he's safe?
What's that?
I said, are Oakland fans still saying Giambi was safe?
They're still mad at him for not sliding, to be honest.
Okay.
That's the main thing I think people think of when it comes to that play.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one. I don't know how he didn't slide. Terrence Long hit it. I was trying to think who was behind him telling him. I guess everyone was just shocked as much as we all were that Jeter actually flipped that ball. So
it was such an unconventional play for you know, the shortstop to be there in that position in the first place to make that kind of, I mean, you just never see guys even in that kind of position. It was like a quarterback kind of freelancing a play like on a two-point conversion or something. You know what I mean? It was just kind of crazy, and just the athleticism and instincts took over. So just a crazy, unusual play, and I mean, gosh, one of the all-time greats, you know. Even as an A's fan, I think you got to appreciate the genius of the play, even if it rips your heart out a little bit.
Right. All right, Joe, well, we appreciate you doing this. And again, you can catch him on the A's Insider Podcast if you want to hear what's going on with some of the Yankee prospects that were traded over to Oakland. I know everyone who's a Yankees fan is really rooting for Dustin Fowler after that gruesome injury in his first major league game.
Yeah, you know what? I got to say hi to him. I just met him briefly. He seems like a really good guy. I'll just tell people, if you want to listen to the podcast, I do a new one every week. You just go to NBCSportsCalifornia.com. And you can check it out there. And you can also subscribe to it on iTunes. Just do a search for the AIDS Insider Podcast with Joe Stiglich, and you just follow it. And it's I get some opposing players and front office and coaches on there, too. So I think it's got some appeal for people, and hopefully people will check it out.
All right, good stuff. We appreciate it, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Hey, guys, thanks for listening to the Bronx Pinstripe Show. Make sure you find us on iTunes and subscribe so you can get all new episodes directly onto your phone. If you do like the show, we'd love for you to take a minute and give us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. It really helps us out and allows us to create more shows. We're on Twitter at Bronx Pinstripes and the same on Facebook. You can always find us there talking Yankee baseball. Thanks again, guys, for your support. Really appreciate it. And go Yankees.